Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
It is 3:03 on Thursday, and that means it's time to meet your maker. I am your host, Rachel Wharton, and I'm very excited today because this is the first time I've ever had a guest whose company was actually so large I could actually find it in my supermarket around the corner, so I'm really excited about this. And also, so his name is Rodney North, and I'm going to let you, he's going to tell us what his title is because it's delightful. And he works for Equal Exchange, and Equal Exchange is like the OG of like a morally, more like to buy commodity foods more like from with a moral sustainable perspective. They've probably been buying coffee beans from farmers they know since Dwayne Sorensen was in grade school. And they have a lot more than that. Bananas, I'm looking at it right now, olive oil, chocolate, other commodity goods. So Rodney, I have two main things I wanted to talk to you about. Well, first of all, tell us what your title is, which I think is hilarious.
So at Equal Exchange, we wear many hats. So mm-hmm. I'm one of the worker owners, a member of the cooperative, but I'm also the answer man.
Which means I'm chewing my pizza.
It's really great pizza.
You come do shows like this with me.
So, right. So I'm our spokesperson, and I handle a lot of our public relations. And I just field lots and lots of questions. I just got a question the other day from a group that wants to start their own importing business, uh-huh. a fair trade business that'll be employee-owned. And we hear from everybody, and it's my job to try to find answers for them.
So when you get asked by people, like someone, maybe you're doing a demo or you're with someone who's doing a demo in a regular supermarket, like the one around the corner from me where I can find some of your products, and people say, what is Equal Exchange? And they don't know anything about the sustainable food world or direct trade, fair trade. How do you answer them?
We are a worker-owned fair trade business.
Right.
So
let's unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. So we're trying to, we have very high ambitions. Even though we're 27 years old, we're still aiming high. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the way we source, which is now known as fair trade. It didn't so much have a name 27 years ago.
Yes, exactly. And I want to hear what it was like when you started.
Yeah, so it's how we source, but also it's how we operate internally. It's how we raise the money to grow mm-hmm. our business. And we now have 130 employees. And it's also how we do the business, how we sell and market and distribute, which includes lots of advocacy, because it's always been our ambition not just to work with farmers in a certain way or to handle organic foods that are more sustainable, but as we say, sort of to be the mosquito on the elephant. So whether it's coffee and trying to introduce the fair trade model, or now with bananas or olive oil, trying to introduce to these industries new ways of working.
And it's commodity industries, right? They're foods that we care a lot about, but are kind of, they're big.
They're big, right.
Where they came from right. Most of the time.
Yeah, it's not like a handmade piece of lace or a uniquely crafted
right.
chair. Yeah, these are commodities that are the lifeblood of economies around the world.
That's
but
so
they're also, you know, it is a livelihood of, you know, Jose the farmer
uh-huh.
in El Salvador, or you know, a single woman farmer in Uganda, but it's also a big this global commodity, which we know over the centuries that it hasn't always been operated in a very nice way,
right?
And we think we can do better.
So I'd actually never heard the saying "the mosquito on the elephant." What does that mean exactly?
That even though that we've gotten bigger now,
mm-hmm.
We're still a very small player in these industries. And also, we have our feet in lots of industries, tea and chocolate and bananas. And so, you know, we're never going to be a multi-billion dollar enterprise like Dole or Hershey. But ideas can be much bigger than what you might think.
Right.
Maybe you have 100 people, but the idea could be much bigger than that. And so take coffee, where we really first had success. And now about 5% of the American coffee market, it's about 100 million pounds, is imported on fair trade terms. And, you know, we probably wouldn't have been able to do that by ourselves.
It's still only, did you say 5%?
Yeah.
It's only 5%.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And that's where we've had the most success. Uh-huh. If you look at tea or bananas or chocolate, it's probably more like 1% or less.
And that's of the whole market, not
of
just
the whole
you.
Market. Right, right. We're a part of the 1%, or we're a part of the 5% that is being brought in on fair trade terms. But, you know, ideas, of course, can be much bigger. And so we can be, you know, to use the mosquito analogy, we can be the vector. You know, we can be the one that introduces this new idea that people say can't be done or isn't necessary. We say, well, no, it is necessary and it can be done and we're going to do it. And we're just going to keep doing it. And we're going to take a little bit of your market share and a little bit of your market share until the industry begins to respond. Like just recently, there was an announcement that Hershey, who was such a laggard when it comes to responsible sourcing, said, yes, we are going to source 100% of our product by 2020 according to one or another certification. Now,
are they, what kind of certification are they like? Are they way, they're falling, they're way behind where you are.
Well, they, for the longest time, they were saying there isn't a problem.
Right.
And whatever 100%. Can be done. Yeah.
Wow.
So, but it really matters when you look at the details.
Right.
And so they're going to be choosing from among three different certifications, and we and others are going to try to keep holding their feet to the fire so that they choose an authentic form of fair trade, which we
think mean 100% fair trade in some way.
No,
they mean 100% something.
Yeah, that 100% of their cocoa will be sourced according to one or another certified method. Some of them,
which they have not said certified in what way.
Well, they've listed the three: OOTS, Rainforest Alliance, and Fair Trade. And it may be 1% fair trade or maybe 90%. And fair trade is the most rigorous of the three. And so people need to be paying attention. But right. I'm getting off the subject. The idea was that, so even in that, the cocoa and chocolate industry, multi-billion dollar industry, that was so resistant to change, we want to be one of those forces that are, you know, introducing this idea, introducing the concept of fair trade, demonstrating that it is commercially viable and that people want it.
Right. They'll pay for it.
They'll pay for it. Retailers want it. They'll put it on their shelves.
Mm-hmm.
And through the magic of the marketplace, if you do something and it works and it's popular, people, for whatever reason, you know, other competitors, will adopt your methods. We want these industries to play our game of an authentic form of fair trade.
You want more competition, in other words.
Yes. So
this is probably a lot easier to do now than it was 28 years ago.
Oh, so much.
Have you been with Equal Exchange for that long?
I've been there 17 years.
17 years. Okay. Pretty long.
And even when we were there, even when I first arrived, it was like a Sisyphusian task, pushing this boulder up a hill, trying to get people like, we want you to understand, you know, where coffee comes from, the reality for those farmers, and that it's grim. It doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
And now, at least with one industry, with coffee, that idea has caught on. And through that, people are more generally becoming aware not only of problems, but of potential ethical responses. And they're realizing, oh, when you pay farmers a decent price and you work with them on the long term, and you work with them directly, it has really good effects upon the quality.
Right.
Oh, isn't that great? Mm. And so now people almost subconsciously are beginning to associate decent practices
with decent
with the best quality product. So we got to keep pushing that. And while it's begun to really take traction or gain traction with coffee, we want to do it with tea. We're going to keep trying to do it with bananas. Keep trying to do it with chocolate or, you know, this olive oil from the West Bank. And because, you know, the food industry is so big and there's so much work to be done. And we seem to be onto something that works, that can be popular. And if we keep doing it, we'll attract others, our peers, and encourage them to adopt such methods.
How did it begin? How did Equal Exchange begin?
So three gentlemen, Rink Dickinson, Jonathan Rosenthal, and Michael Rosine, were working in the food industry in the Northeast in a cooperatively owned business called Northeast Distributors.
They distributed to co-ops, or was it bigger than
food co-ops, independent grocery stores, food buying clubs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was a business owned by the customers. And they were working with New England farmers, but also handling international products. And this is back in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
And they were politically aware. And they began to realize, okay, we're doing some good work with New England farmers, and we're trying to source more organic products. But what about the coffee and the rice and the banana chips that we're bringing in?
The banana chips, yes.
And, you know, because the
staple of the co-op.
Yeah, our modern shopping cart, mm-hmm. so to speak, is full of stuff from all over the world. And they were asking, can we do this in another way that respects the farmer and redivides the shopping dollar and also redivides who has power in the marketplace? And, you know, we know the struggles of American farmers.
When you say who has power in the marketplace, what exactly are you, do you mean by that? You mean like which type of farmer or which type of buyer or both?
It's all of the above. So, for example, consumers didn't have much power.
Right.
Because they didn't know the stories behind the products. You know, coffee was coffee and lettuce was lettuce. Again, we're talking about the 80s.
Right.
And if you don't know the issues, if you don't know the stories behind this coffee versus that coffee, you can't act. You don't have information to act on, and you don't have choices to choose from. And so they were trying to change that, to educate people about, oh, wait a minute, there's a story about where your coffee came from.
But only within a co-op at that point, right? In a very specific type of market. Back in the early days.
Yeah. The food cooperatives like Park Slope here in Brooklyn and others around the country, they were definitely the first to get it. They've always been the pioneer on all kinds of food issues. Because they weren't in it for profit. They were in it to source good, wholesome food in a way that respect the interest of their co-op members. So they were our first market, our first allies, you know, here in the retail scene. And so back to your question about who has power in the marketplace. So consumers didn't have power. Even people who were trying, like distributors and grocery stores, progressive ones, who were trying to make the right choices, they only had sort of the same generic choices in front of them.
Right.
So not until someone provides an organic choice, a fair trade source, can they then exercise their ability, to choose this over that. But it goes right down the line. And when you look at the farmers, like American farmers, the small scale farmer, the man or the woman with 5 acres in Peru, they're price takers. They just have to take whatever is given. And the norm had been that no access to information, where was the product going, what was the world price that day for coffee, and they had no leverage. They just had to deliver the coffee to the intermediaries, the coyotes, who were buying it, and that was the end of their participation. They just took what they can get, and they just did that generation after generation.
We're going to take a 1 minute break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to hear more about the supply chain, which is really interesting to me.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Did you know that pollinators are needed for more than 2/3 of the world's crop species? Most of these pollinators are bees. However, North America's bee population has been steadily declining since the 1990s. Whether you live in the country or the city, you can show your commitment by hosting a hive in your backyard or even on a rooftop. The beekeeping movement is growing, so you're sure to find swarms of folks who can help you find your way. Learn more about the ways you can help be the solution at wholefoodsmarket.com/sharethebuzz.
Trust in them above instinct.
Welcome back to Meet Your Maker. Today we are talking to Rodney North, who is the answer man, the public face, I suppose, of Equal Exchange, which does fairly traded products of all kinds, granola bars, olive oil, chocolate, and coffee. We were talking about the early days when a group of people who distributed food for co-ops started looking at some of the other products that they sold, like rice and coffee, and trying to figure out if there was a way to reform those markets as well. And I'm curious, and you were saying that how the farmer in Peru with 5 acres had absolutely no choices. He sold to whoever he could sell to for whatever price. How do you go make that relationship? Like especially back in the 80s, do you just go to Peru? Like, how did it start?
Yeah, literally. Well, first, the three gentlemen, Rink, Michael and Jonathan, they were unable to persuade Northeast to tackle this problem. And so they went off on their own, and they got money from friends and family and credit cards, and to launch Equal Exchange. And our opening day was May 1st, uh-huh. International Labor Day, 1986. And yes, they would sometimes need to go to places like Peru or El Salvador to find the first farmer partners. But also, they were able to talk to like-minded people in Europe, uh-huh. who were beginning to tackle the same problem. And that's what led to the first product called Café Nica, the forbidden coffee from Nicaragua. This is during the Sandinista regime after overthrowing the Somoza dictatorship. But we didn't have the internet. There are a lot of faxes. We still have the correspondence, uh-huh. back from the 80s. With trying to find groups that were trying to make a difference on the ground, you know, bringing farmers together. There were some farmer cooperatives, not as many as today. Some of the cooperatives were started by government initiative. Sometimes they were started despite government opposition, mm-hmm. in these countries. And talking to really other like-minded people, it's like, oh, you're already working with a farmer co-op in Mexico. You know, maybe they have more coffee to sell. They could sell some to us.
So did you hear war stories? Like, was it hard? Were they almost giving up back then?
The farmers themselves?
Yeah.
Well, both, you know.
Yeah, we heard and in some sense, saw the really difficult stories ourselves. The very first fair trade cooperative, Usiri, from Oaxaca, Mexico, they co-founded the idea of fair trade foods with a Dutch NGO called Solidaridad. And they had over 20 members, farmer members, assassinated during their years of trying to form the co-op because, you know, basically the elite of the Oaxacan countryside or southern Mexico, they liked the status quo. You know, they got good, cheap coffee that they could sell in the international market. They didn't want competition for that. And so they were killing members of this startup cooperative. And in my first visit to Chiapas, Mexico in 1994, I remember I opened a paper and there was a story of a co-op leader killed on his doorstep. I go back 3 years later, now with Equal Exchange, 1997. Again, I open a paper, somebody else is killed from another cooperative.
And 1997 or 80?
97.
Oh, okay.
So that's a full decade after the start of fair trade. But in some countries like Costa Rica, the government has been supportive of cooperatives. Elsewhere, either the local elites, you know, the moneyed interest, literally resort to murder. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole spectrum of resistance. And even today, even if it's not always violence, there are lots of ways to undermine a cooperative. Basically, like, you can imagine a large buyer comes into community, will offer so much money, uh-huh. that the farmers will sell their coffee or whatever the product is to the corporation, which means the local co-op has no product, has nothing to sell.
And this was strictly coffee. It was not cocoa beans.
For us, yeah, we were starting with coffee, but these mechanisms, yeah. of undermining farmer cooperatives can be found around the world, mm-hmm. right. whether it's rice or bananas or coffee.
But the conflict was mostly in coffee.
No, I think it's probably any commodity. Well, it was all bananas,
sugar. Yeah. So our founding was around coffee.
Yeah.
I'm actually curious, yes. now 28 years later, you now sell lots of product to mainstream markets around the country, maybe even internationally.
Export a little bit. Yeah.
How and you're still a cooperatively owned. Not you don't just work with cooperatives. You are also a cooperatively owned.
Yes.
How do you scale up and stay true to what you want to do? Like, how does that work? Like, do you just work with more and more small cooperatives? Like, how is your product delivered? I mean, how does it work when you grow large?
Well, one of the things was critical was that we weren't built to scale, but we were built to stay independent, and which is why that's half of your question. How did you grow large,
and
a larger,
stay true to your mission,
stay on mission? So the worker cooperative structure is critical to that. One worker, one share of stock, one vote. So rank: co-executive director, a co-founder. Still, he has one share of stock, he has one vote. New woman in the warehouse, one share of stock, one vote. And so we, the people who show up every day, who move the coffee, roast the coffee, ship out the tea, we're the owners, and we can keep equal exchange on mission. And this is rare in the food industry, whether it's, you know, Dagoba or Green and Black or Honest Tea.
They're not cooperatives.
They're not independent. They've all been bought up by Kraft and Kellogg and Hershey's and Cadbury. And
can you give an example of a kind of decision that you have to struggle over as a group?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So we've been growing steadily. Uh-huh. We've grown for 27 years on average, about 10 to 25% a year, which is enough. We can handle that growth, but without getting too big and losing, you know, what the point is. So we had to move. We were bursting at the seams. Uh-huh. My office was in the basement of a plumbing shop next to our headquarters because there was nowhere else to put the marketing department. Anyway, so we needed to move. And as a group, we would pile into buses and go around to different potential warehouses that we could buy. And so it wouldn't be like three people showing up to check it out. It'd be 30, 40 people piling out of a bus. And we had a debate, like, if we go further, we can get cheaper real estate, and which would be good for the economics of the business, and that's good because we're owners. But if we move too far, people will be left behind. You know, they can't move 30 miles because they got kids in school or whatever the reason. And so we had to debate that out. Like right now, we're growing in Oregon, and we'll have a meeting soon to talk about what will be the next Oregon location. And it's something we're going to have to decide democratically, you know, one person, one vote. And also, remember, we're trying to bring these fair trade ideas to new categories. Well, that means risk.
Right.
Like when we got into the banana business, that is controlled by $5 billion companies.
And they're more perishable than some of the other things you've been doing, too.
Yeah.
Right.
If you buy coffee, like green coffee, and it doesn't sell today, that's fine.
Right.
You know, it'll be there and you can roast it next week or next month. You buy bananas, and if they don't sell, they turn into mush, and you've just lost $20,000-$30,000.
So does that mean you had to invest in infrastructure to store the bananas, or did you somehow avoid that whole thing?
Not so much, because we can go work with businesses, and all they do is they ripen bananas, and they store and distribute bananas. But my point was that this was a big issue for us, the worker owners, to decide. Are we going to, and we're working on very thin margins because we're in very competitive industries against very big competitors. Do we want to take on another challenge like competing with Dolan and Chiquita, where the prospects of success are faint and the risks are high? And we debated it. We had long meetings about the banana operation, what the risks were, and we decided, yes, that the banana business was too important not to try to bring fair trade to it. And we didn't trust the big corporations to do it right, so we'd have to get in there ourselves, despite the risk. But that was a decision made by the worker owners themselves.
Have you looked into coconuts?
Oh, yeah.
We haven't, but there is a great fair trade enterprise in New Zealand called Trade Aid, and they're trying to do some cool stuff in the South Pacific.
Your banana arm is newer?
Yes.
Like you see your coffee everywhere and your chocolate now too, but I don't think I can buy a fair trade banana or any equal exchange banana in any mainstream grocery store I've ever seen. Probably in the co-ops, but I should request them.
Well, we do distribute them from Maine to Richmond, Virginia, all the way out to Ohio. We also distribute a lot around Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin. And so really, it's just a matter of the retailers coming to know.
Right.
I hope there's some retailers out there listening.
Also, because every coffee shop that I go to cares a lot about where almost everything they have on their shelves, and then they almost always sell bananas. And they should all be selling fair trade or equal exchange bananas.
Yes.
These places in particular.
And we just need more conversations like this.
Yeah.
And because really, all these same issues play out, whether it's tea or bananas. And just... it sounds funny, but banana has been a tougher nut to crack.
Yes. Because people are so used to paying a quarter.
Almost nothing, yeah.
You know?
Which is crazy when you think about it. I know. There's a whole book about this, but it's very dense and academic.
Some of them are less dense, but there are some great books out there about the banana trade. But yeah, nutritious, convenient, incredible, but so cheap. And a lot of that cheapness is artificial. It really is coming on the back of the banana farmer. So we're trying to change that.
Oh my gosh, we have 2 minutes left, but I wanted to ask how your ability to scale it's probably helped and hindered by the fact that you focus on products that are you're not sourcing. These products aren't locally sourced, or they're not sourced in America, which probably doesn't meet, which you can avoid a lot of arguments about distributing across the country that way, I imagine. Like, it helps and hinders what you're doing a little bit. Does my question make any sense?
It does. Because we have an international focus, there's not a local issue. You're not going to grow coffee locally. Tea doesn't grow locally. Bananas don't grow locally. We try to be an international farmer's market to complement your local farmer's market. For all those things...
that we're going to buy no matter what.
They're going to come from overseas. What would be the most sort of inspiring alternative for it?
I would like peppercorns. That's a big one.
Actually, the business Frontier is a good place to look at. They do a lot of responsible sourcing. Much of it is fair trade sourced. Yeah.
So with such a little bit amount of time, I would like anyone listening to please go and request equal exchange bananas in their local grocery store.
Yes, please
the coffee,
do.
Your coffee's probably
and
already
also
there.
Local coffee shops as well.
Really, wherever bananas are sold, people can learn more at www.equalexchange.coop.
I didn't even know you could get that as an end.
Yeah, it's our domain because we're cooperative, like organicvalley.coop. But also, we have a special banana site, which is Beyond the Peel.
Oh, man.
.com,
that's
I think.
Hilarious.
Yeah, that's our banana site. And all of this, whether it's olive oil or our work with churches and schools, it really comes down to people taking initiative saying, hey, you know, there's this exciting alternative out there. Could we get this for our church? Can we get these bananas for our grocery store? And retailers largely, you know, they want to sell you what you want. So tell them what you want.
And also, if you want to learn a whole lot more, which I do, Rodney's also, he also was earlier taped another interview. So you can hear probably a whole lot more on heritageradionetwork.org. This has been Meet Your Maker. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.